At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The economy is not fixed yet. Unemployment's not fixed yet. But the deficit and deficit reduction are hot as a pistol right now in Washington. The chairman of a bipartisan panel set up by President Obama to tackle the problem are out with their outline. Would it work and would it be fair? This hour On Point, honing in on deficit reduction. We'll hear in a moment from inequality expert Jacob Hacker. But first, from Washington, Lori Montgomery is with us, financial reporter for The Washington Post. Lori, thank you very much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Remind us, broad stroke, what's in here? We'll dive into what the reaction's been. But what is the shape of this glimpse that Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles have given us?
Well, they've tackled just about every area of the problem that experts have been saying for years needs to be tackled. They're calling for fairly dramatic reductions in discretionary spending, including the Pentagon, and those are the budgets that run most of federal Washington, all the agency budgets. They're calling for reductions in entitlement spending. They did not take a particular target to Medicare on the theory that the recent health care bill already sliced about $500 billion out of Medicare over the next 10 years. But they did tackle Social Security reform. They're looking to raise the retirement age, raise the early retirement age, reduce benefits for wealthier retirees. And they're looking to slow down the rate at which your benefits increase over time. And then finally, they're looking to institute a fairly dramatic overhaul of the tax code that would wipe out just about all of the major deductions that people have become accustomed to, such as the home mortgage interest deduction, charitable deductions, state and local tax deductions for those of you who live in states without an income tax. All of those would be gone. In exchange, people would get lower rates, but overall tax collections would rise in the U.S.
Now, you say wipe out deductions. Let's take the mortgage interest deduction. Would it really wipe that out or just lower the cap? You can deduct up to, what is it, the deduction on up to $1 million mortgage now? Would that just go down to $500,000 or be gone?
Well, it's a little confusing because there are three different proposals on tax reform. One is the zero option that completely wipes out all of the deductions. It wipes out not just mortgage interest, but the tax-free treatment of employer-provided health care.
Mm-hmm.
Gone. You would, in the future, be taxed on the value of what your employer spends to give you health insurance. So this is a pretty radical plan. It would reduce tax rates pretty substantially. From the lowest rate would go down to 8%, and the higher rate, I believe, would go to 23%, down from the current 35%. But there are two other options on the table, and one is a more moderate version of this plan. It was developed by Senator Wyden and Senator Gregg. That would, in fact, limit some of these deductions. And one of their proposals is to limit the mortgage interest cap to homes of around $500,000 and to get rid of it for second homes. And then there's still a third tax reform option that would simply instruct the Treasury to come up with a plan that would increase revenues to around 21% of GDP.
So it could be gone on the home mortgage interest deduction, or it could be capped. What's the profile of reaction so far, Lori? I mean, this is a great big trial balloon, a trial blimp. I don't know what you call it. How's Washington responding?
Nobody's for this. absolutely nobody is for this. This is not going to be enacted into law anytime soon, and that's what people should know. The Deficit Commission is going to meet again tomorrow and the next day, and then again early next week, and they're going to try to vote on something next Wednesday. But nobody really expects them to be able to come to agreement. I mean, the liberals on the commission and off the commission have just absolutely gone bonkers over the Social Security cuts, saying they cannot support them, unfair, taxes should be raised, we shouldn't be cutting benefits. Conservatives on and off the commission have said they don't like the increases in tax collections, even though tax rates would go down, overall collections throughout society would rise, so they don't like that. So, you know, there's going to be some massaging of this thing, but in terms of anything being adopted anytime soon, we're looking at, you know, into next year when we see which parts of this the president might adopt in his budget proposal, you know, which parts Democrats and Republicans might pick up in their budget resolutions that they will come out with in the spring. And, you know, it's going to be a while before we see whether any of this is politically viable.
Into next year, but then this is setting a structure that would affect Americans for most of this next century. And so the stakes are high, even if the action may not be imminent. Laurie Montgomery with The Washington Post. Thank you very much for being with us, Laurie.
Sure thing.
Joining me now from New Haven, Connecticut, is Jacob Hacker, professor of political science at Yale, co-author with Paul Pearson of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. He's got plenty to say on deficit reduction plans. Jacob Hacker, welcome back to On Point.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Tom.
So big picture, what do you say here? You've come out pretty harsh on this. Don't we have a problem? Don't we have to dig in somewhere? Wouldn't this be a way?
Well, I think the way to understand this is that we've had a big party in our economy that has only been enjoyed by really a very small slice of Americans. It's as if that party had a roped-off bar that was handing out free drinks. And all of a sudden, the party crashers come, Simpson and Bowles, and they say, "Oh, guys, this party's got to end. The party's over, folks, and we've all got to pay the tab." Now, I think a lot of the Americans who are facing the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, the 24 million Americans who are unemployed or underemployed, are wondering, wait, you know, when did the party start, and when did we get to be part of it? So I think the first thing to just emphasize is that deficit reduction, you know, as a priority, is way down the list for most Americans right now. A poll that was done by CBS News said that economy and jobs, 56% of Americans said that should be the top priority for the new Congress, whereas both tax cuts and deficits, taxes as an issue and deficits, were in the low single digits. And those are the two things that people are talking about in Washington. As you said at the start, deficit reduction is suddenly hot as a pistol. And the way that Paul Pearson and I talk about this is as if there's two worlds, Planet Washington and the rest of the world, Planet Earth. And right now, Planet Washington seems to be in a completely different place from the rest of the world.
But a lot of people have said Planet Washington doesn't understand that sooner or later it's got to get its fiscal house in order. Here's a big, broad swipe at beginning to do that, and this is obviously going to be a conversation that goes on for many years in this country. If this is the framework, Jacob Hacker, is this an equitable foundation to lay down for the kind of changes we may need to contemplate?
No, I'm afraid it's not. And, you know, I think this is being understood way too much in terms of, you know, left and right versus the responsible center, when in fact these choices are pretty straightforward. We know that the long-term deficit problem is primarily a problem of runaway health care costs. And the runaway health care costs are partially addressed with the new health care reform legislation. In fact, you know, the people calling for repeal of that legislation rarely note that it would reduce the deficit substantially over the next 10 years and puts in place, as Laurie Montgomery said, a slowdown in Medicare. So it's disappointing to me that the core area that we need to address, which is how to slow health care costs over the long term, is not really addressed in this initial proposal. I mean, the stress is on domestic discretionary cuts, which you know, are a very small part of the overall long-term budget picture. And at the same time, on Social Security, which doesn't contribute to the deficit over this period. I mean, we need to deal with Social Security because we want to make sure it pays promised benefits. But if you're asking what's the serious deficit problem, it's runaway health care costs. And essentially, in the commission's proposal, that's kind of a magic asterisk that will hold federal health spending to some capped rate, which is a pretty low rate. And yet there's not many specifics about how that would be done. So to me, this we have to ask, why are we having this conversation right now? There are three possible reasons. One is that this is the right moment to start actually reducing the deficit. And that's what the commission says. They say next year, October, we should start cutting the deficit. And that's not true, that this is the right time right now. So the second question is, you know, maybe the second reason is that we need to deal with this over the longer term. And absolutely we do. But then we need a balanced package to do so. And this isn't one.
Not a balanced package. If this were imposed just as it is, what would the impact be on equality in this country? That's your specialty.
Yeah. I mean, so as I said, it's as if the bar that was, you know, roped off and the really top richest Americans were enjoying, you know, really nice treatment at the bar. It's as if suddenly we're just going to stop that party and not let a lot of Americans who are on the other side of the ropes enjoy some of the prosperity.
I really don't get your metaphor. Are you saying this would create more fairness or less?
It would create less fairness because over the last generation, we've seen the share of income going to the richest, 1% of Americans go from less than 10% to over 23%. And this basically would lock in that stark inequality. Most of these changes are some of them are progressive on the spending side, but most of these changes basically reflect the idea that the main thing that has to be done is we need to cut spending. And that's going to hit middle class and working class Americans more heavily. The tax changes, particularly the ones that are most realistic in the current climate, are ones that will actually bring down tax rates on the well-off. So there are some ideas in here that I think are very useful, but and I know Maya agrees with this, but I think there's very little influence. Maya McGinnis, who will be on the show later, agrees with this. There's very little emphasis on the hyper inequality that we've seen over the last generation.
There are Democrats out there, many complaining. Some won here on the panel, Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota, saying he doesn't support all of it, but says it's time. Something's got to be done.
A certain amount of this is shock therapy. There are different options, and of course, what everybody is fastened on are the most extreme of the options. But look, the important thing for people to know is we are borrowing 40 cents of every dollar we spend. That's utterly unsustainable. It can't continue much longer. So it's got to be dealt with.
Democratic Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota on ABC's This Week. Jacob Hacker joins us from New Haven, Connecticut. We're joined right now as well from Washington by Maya McGinnis, President of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Director of the Fiscal Policy Program at the New America Foundation. The Wall Street Journal calls her an anti-deficit warrior. Maya McGinnis, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me.
Jacob Hacker is worried that now is not the time, A, and B, this will not be an equitable way of addressing our deficit. What do you say?
Well, I have to say I'm sympathetic to some of the points that Jacob makes, but overall I disagree. So let's go back to Jacob's metaphor about the party. The problem that we've been having in this country for more than a decade now, certainly, has been that there's been a party for mentality for everybody. This is the first time in a decade that I can recall some important institution coming out with really serious proposals for how to deal with the deficit and debt. For me personally, running a responsible budget group, I realized I barely even know how to write a positive press release. It's been so long we've been fretting about all the policies that would add to the deficit and debt. And this is a huge, credible, game-changing plan that would actually tackle the problems.
Well, you say it will tackle the problems, but there's been a party for everybody. But Jacob Hacker, of course, and Paul Pearson have been writing very compellingly about how it hasn't been the same party for everybody. That's for sure. That, you know, so much of the rewards of this society and its economy have gone to a teeny tiny percentage at the top in recent decades, much more than was the pattern in mid-20th century America. And he says, you know, this would lock in that inequitable structure.
Yeah, so the part of what Jacob was talking about that I really am sympathetic to is we have a huge problem in this country of growing income inequality, and it's been exacerbated in past years. And that is something that we have to take real serious pains to restructure our economy. It's structural problems in our economy. That said, the fiscal party that we've been throwing has gone for borrowing for policies that affected everybody, upper end, middle end, lower end, and we basically have to break the dependency on borrowing across the board. The way that I've been thinking about this is that I think we really have to be very serious about controlling spending. Spending in Washington is on a trajectory to grow to much, much levels than we've ever seen historically in this country, and I think this plan does an important job in doing that.
We'll look at spending. Yes, please, Maya. Sorry.
We also have to restructure our tax code fundamentally, and it does a really good job of that. But I would say that on the spending parts of the plan, it's very careful to do it in a progressive way where it protects people who depend on the programs, and that's critically important. On the tax part of the plan, if I were suggesting improvements, I would say they should also make the tax proposals more progressive than they currently are to reflect this growing income inequality. But the bottom line is this plan now sets a new bar for we have to make changes to the deficit and debt. We can't continue borrowing. If you don't like proposals in this plan, let's think of different ones. I wrote a piece today on a couple ways that you could change it and improve it, including making some more progressive changes on the tax side. But it's no longer a time to say we can borrow indefinitely because that's a surefire recipe for a fiscal crisis. And this is such an act, I think, of courage to say, let's put it out there to the country. Let's talk about what's going to be involved. People are not going to like these choices. But the truth is, if the plan had come out and the reaction had been, you know, great, this sounds great, that wouldn't have been a credible plan. That would have been more borrowing, more of the same. This is what it's going to take.
No edge on that knife. We'll dive in on spending and on taxes. But Jacob Hacker, first of all, Maya says, look, everybody's been partying here.
Well, I mean, that's simply not true if you look at the distribution of economic gains. And the last decade is really telling. You know, if you look at just from the 2002 to 2007 economic expansion, more than half of all economic gains, household economic gains, went to the richest 1%. And really, the gains are very concentrated even within the top 1%. One thing that I think is it tends to be missed as we discuss you know, it's striking to me that we're discussing these huge tax cuts for the very richest, $700 billion to provide tax breaks to the top 2% of Americans, most of which goes to the richest of the rich. And at the same time, which is that $700 billion is enough to close the entire long-term Social Security shortfall. That at the same time as we're talking about that, then there's this heavy emphasis on the need for, you know, Americans to tighten their belt. So I think that there certainly is, and we cannot borrow indefinitely. And as I said up front, we know that the principal long-term deficit problem is healthcare costs. And I've been a longtime advocate of more serious measures to control costs across the entire healthcare system, not just on the backs of Medicare beneficiaries. But the reason that I'm concerned about these proposals is twofold. First, I'm concerned that they start too early, and we're talking about next October. We start cutting back spending quite substantially.
And that's an economic argument, you're saying. This economy is not ready to take that.
That
out of the economy, and we'll be worse off.
Exactly. And the second concern I have is precisely what you said up front, that as Paul Pierce and I argue in our book, Winner Take All Politics, we've seen a shift of our politics and public policy in ways that have favored those at the top. I don't see any willingness to confront that fundamental problem in Washington today. And yes, there are a few proposals in this package that would push back a bit, but overall it basically accepts that we're going to have a much more unequal society than most Americans want or that we had in the past.
Could you be specific about what in this plan would create or perpetuate that inequality? For example, on Social Security, I think the affluent would pay more under this and get less, while the poor would get more. That sounds like the kind of progressive element that Maya was talking about. Where do you see the problems in terms of, you know, the structure of who's got what in this country?
Well, I think that the problems are more in the overall structure of the proposal, so that it leans heavily on spending cuts, and spending is generally more favorable to middle and lower income Americans than it is to those at the top. It is true that in this, and the Social Security fixes, remember, don't affect the long-term deficit. They do have some important progressive elements, but we should keep in mind that when we're talking about rising inequality, it's really the middle class and the working and lower class that's lost out to the super rich. And the proposals don't really address that. For example, it raises the payroll tax, the amount that it hits, up to 90% of the wage distribution. But I would argue we could go even higher. And in fact, if we went higher, we could close much of the gap without having to cut back benefits for middle-class beneficiaries. The other area where it really locks in inequality is that it basically makes a huge concession to the tax-cutting agenda by capping over the next decade the amount of spending at a level that is actually below the average for the last 25 years. Even though we have the baby boomers retiring, even though healthcare costs are much higher now than in the past, it's basically saying we have to do this mostly by cutting spending, even though most Americans think that for programs like Social Security and Medicare and making sure that first responders and teachers have employment, and that we should be actually bringing in more revenue.
So you'd rather have higher taxes laid out here and fewer cuts in spending over the next 10, 50 years?
Yes, I would, and I'd like more serious effort on healthcare cost control with serious proposals put forth that would get us from here to much lower rates of growth of Medicare and Medicaid spending and healthcare costs overall.
Maya McGinnis, of course, this goes to a core Democrat versus Republican argument about what portion of the society's wealth ought to go into government spending. Republicans always looking to have that down. Democrats have helped push it up and have created some valuable programs with that. But also, you know, we've got this huge deficit. So do you see the right balance in here? Is this an assault on the middle class to cap that percentage of the GDP that goes to spending over time?
Yeah, let me respond to a couple of the points Jacob made. So as a political independent, I look at this plan and I think it does seem like it's a pretty good balance. We're hearing criticisms on both sides. That's usually a sign that we've sort of gone after some of the sacred cows that both sides care about the most. And I think that's right, that the real problem in the fiscal future that we face is on the spending side of the budget. It's spending growth that is going to really cause the problems. That said, nobody should be pretending that we can fix the problems on spending alone. Revenues are going to have to be part of the solution. And I think they come up with a good balance. There are just a couple specifics I want to go over. Mm-hmm. Jacob was talking about how the tax cuts for the well-off would add to the debt over the next 10 years by about $700 billion. That's correct. What he doesn't point out, though, is that the rest of the tax cuts that everybody seems to support extending, I wouldn't say that we should, but they would cost $3 trillion. So we can't pretend that the tax cutting agenda is just for the super rich. The $3 trillion is for everybody, including the people making below $250,000. $1,000 a year, and we need to rethink extending those tax cuts across the board. Second, on health care, we did just reform health care. And one of the things that I would say was a problem from the fiscal perspective is that all the savings we generated, we plowed back into more spending on health care. And Jacob said there was big deficit reduction out of the health care plan. That's not true. There's very, very small deficit reduction if we get it right. Let's hope we do. But I think the mistake we made is that we focused more on expanding coverage before we got our health care costs under control. And unfortunately, we still have to make more changes there. We don't really know how. And if we sit around and wait to do anything else in the budget until we figure out how to fix health care, when we've already given away the bulk of the savings, we will wait for too long, and that will cause a real problem. And then finally, on the economic recovery, that is a situation that I'm very concerned about. I think that the fiscal getting on top of the fiscal challenges we face is really part of an economic recovery plan. So I think that there's room for more stimulus in the short run. I know that's become a bad word in some circles, but I think you put a down payment to make sure we don't go back into a recession. But we will not have a sustained economic recovery in this country if we continue to borrow at excessive levels. So you have to do two things. You have to worry about the short term, meaning the next year or two, and you also have to put a plan in place as quickly as possible and phase it in gradually as the economy recovers to get our borrowing dependency down. That is one of the most important components of getting the economy strong and growing again.
Maya, Jacob, stand by. I want to bring our listeners in here. Margarita in Providence, Rhode Island. Margarita, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I think the thing that bothers me about all of this discussion is, and I'm a baby boomer, is that nobody's talking about how to address these issues in terms of an investment in the future. It's all about seniors, and I hate to admit it, but, you know, I'm one of those.
Right.
And what about our kids? What about our grandkids? And, you know, I'm just, like, looking at my grandchildren's future and just shuddering at what they face, and it seems like we ought to be willing to pick up the tab, that is taxes, and we ought to think about where we spend money as investments. And I heard people talking about the need for more infrastructure and more sort of stimulus spending in that respect. And I just think that for an equal society, we need to be looking progressively at the tax rate. We need to get rid of some of the stupid exemptions that are in the tax code. When Timothy Geithner can't do his own taxes, you know we have a problem.
And what if it means Social Security cuts, Margarita? You're 61. You're looking at that future.
Well, you know, I'm sort of willing to, and full disclosure, I'm actually in the civil service system, and so we almost have a golden parachute in that system. Once you've been in there for 30 years, you know, you can retire, and it's got a fee.
I see. So you're ready to cut, but it wouldn't be your.
No, but I would be willing to cut from that too. And I'm betting that as that system ages out, that they're going to fold us into Social Security. So I have no expectations that that's going to stay the same. But I think we should all just bite the bullet and deal with this.
Let's bite the bullet, you said. Margarita, I appreciate your call. Jacob, what do you say to Margarita and people like her out there who say, you know, we've got to get on top of this for the good of our children, our grandchildren, and they're ready to do it, sort of sober, good-hearted, ready to, you know, chip in and maybe take some hit if that's what it takes to get us back on a balanced keel.
I wish people like Margarita were the ones driving this debate, because she's got it absolutely right, that we need to make investments in the future. And the most important short-term investment we can make is to get this economy going again, because that's the key to long-term deficit reduction and to putting our fiscal house in order. I mean, if you look at the one time in the past generation in which we've actually brought the deficit down, it was brought about because of the strong growth of the 1990s. I also agree with her that taxes, revenues have to be on the table. And right now there's a party that is basically saying that that's off the table completely. And I commend Maya for taking the sort of position that this is essential, that we have to put revenues on the table. But I worry a bit that this proposal reflects a kind of political concession to the reality that there's basically no political will on one side of the aisle to look at the revenue side, to look at taxes at all. And the last thing I would say is I just want to reiterate that this isn't about – I put out a proposal in my prior book, The Great Risk Shift, for bringing Social Security into long-term balance. That is not the deficit problem. The deficit problem is caused principally by runaway health care costs. And so we can talk endlessly about how we want to fix Social Security and what the ideal situation would be. I think it's worth noting that most Americans, unlike Margarita, no longer have a defined private pension. And in fact, the Deficit Commission would get rid of the tax breaks, or one version would get rid of the tax breaks for 401ks. So we have to think that Social Security is going to be really the principal source of retirement income for middle class and lower income Americans. And so we really have to take that seriously. But again, that is not the principal long-term deficit problem. And that really, I think Margarita's got it right, that investment is at the core of the creation of the middle class, and it's at the core of the preservation of the middle class going forward, and we're not talking about that.
Maya, we just got a minute before the break, but do you see the risk here of locking in the kind of inequality that we've grown into here, or, you know, do we have to just take action or else the whole economy is in trouble?
Well, I think there's no question that if we fail to act on the fiscal problems that we face, and we either are locked into slow growth for years, if not decades, or even worse, we have some kind of a fiscal crisis where those who are lending us money suddenly say, you don't look like such a good risk anymore, and we're going to charge you more, our interest rates are going to go up, that's going to derail the whole recovery. That is bad for everybody, really bad. At the same time, I think in terms of the economic inequality issues, there are structural economic questions that we have to deal with. We need an innovation policy in this country. We need a competitiveness policy in the country. But I will tell you that raising taxes up too high does not help that. Again, I am sympathetic to progressive tax structure. That's my personal preference. And I think it should be more progressive than it's been in the past. Also, I think our spending programs need to be more progressive than they've been in the past. We need to protect those who depend on them and ask people who don't to sacrifice a little bit more.
Joining us right now from Washington is Ryan Ellis. He's director of tax policy at Americans for Tax Reform. It's a group founded and led by conservative activist Grover Norquist. Ryan Ellis, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here.
What do you make of, as Alan Simpson says, what's on the table for us all to chew on?
Well, the problem that with this plan is that it has $1 trillion in net tax increases over the next decade. That's according to the plan zone score. Over the long run, what this plan seeks to do is raise the target for federal tax revenues from 18% of GDP, which is what it's been historically, to a consistent 21% of GDP, which it hasn't technically touched 21% of GDP ever. It's come close a couple of times. But keeping it there over the long run would give us a historically extremely high level of taxation. And frankly, we don't have an under-taxing problem over the next 10 and 100 years. We have an overspending problem.
So, but if we've got a big deficit, isn't it sort of common sense that we may need to cut spending and raise taxes? Isn't that how you, that's how a household over time gets out of debt?
Well, you have to look at what the deficit is being caused by. The deficit is just the answer to an arithmetic problem. The deficit is just revenue minus spending or spending minus revenue, depending how you look at it. And it doesn't really tell you much unless you look at what went into that arithmetic problem. Are taxes coming in too low? The answer is no. According to the Congressional Budget Office, even if all the January 2011 tax hikes were avoided, even if the AMT was patched forever, et cetera, no taxes ever raised, by the end of this decade, federal taxes would be coming in at 18% of GDP, which is their historical norm. So clearly there's not an under-taxing problem. The source of the deficit, 100%, I would argue, of the source of the deficit comes from spending. And so if you're going to try to do taxes and spending, you're ignoring what the actual cause of the deficit is, which is all spending.
Maya McGinnis, what do you say? Pair federal spending back to 18% of GDP instead of 21, and we'll be fine.
Well, what I've noticed in these discussions is that you have sort of the liberal side of it talking about how we need to invest more and we need to build bridges and, you know, create a bigger, bolder economy with government spending, and that will help us grow our way out. And then you have the conservative side saying, no, 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 we need to cut more taxes and that will help have a thriving economy. And you know, if it's too good, if it sounds too good to be true, it usually is too good to be true. We do need more investment in our budget and we do need a saner, fundamentally reformed tax system. But neither of those are the same as adding more to the deficit by cutting more taxes or adding more spending. And what would be really helpful is if you heard liberals saying, here's all the tax increases I think we should consider. And the conservatives saying, listen, these Social Security and Medicare and defense cuts are all good, but here are the next round of them that we need to add to it rather than having tax increases. But right now, there's not a single plan out there that shows how you could fix this whole problem 100% through spending cuts and not have the debt levels be too high. It's just unworkable. You have those on the right who are saying, we don't want to touch Medicare or we don't want to touch Social Security. That kind of reasoning doesn't add up. So we have to start talking about the harder choices, not kind of the, oh, it would be great if we could grow our way out of this problem through, you know, lots of fun-sounding policies and a little bit of wishful thinking. It's not going to work. We need to be more realistic. And I think this plan is really realistic. And yes, there are going to be a lot of hard things in it.
Ryan, what do you say to that that view? Can't do it through spending cuts alone. You've got to have more revenue in here.
Well, there are two problems here. And unfortunately, a lot of times in these debates, we tend to commingle them. But they really need to be treated separately. The first challenge is, how do you balance the budget in the next 5 or 10 years? That's problem number one. Problem number two is, how do you prevent this explosion of entitlement spending over the rest of this century? The first problem you can absolutely deal with without any tax increases whatsoever. And by the way, no one's talking about new tax cuts. What we're talking about is not raising existing taxes. Dan Mitchell and the Cato Institute came out with a very simple, easy chart, something that everybody should be able to understand readily, showing that if you avoid all of these tax increases over the next 10 years, you don't raise any taxes at all, you could actually take today's level of government spending, which is post-stimulus, post-TARP, post-everything, mm-hmm. a very bloated level of government spending. You could take today's level of government spending, actually grow it at 2% a year over the next decade, roughly keeping it pace with inflation, and you'd have a balanced budget at the end of that period. So you can absolutely do a spending cuts, or even not even that much spending cuts, just a spending restraint plan over the next decade without raising taxes, and you can balance the budget. If you want to do a program that fixes the long-term problems, what I would suggest people take a look at is what Paul Ryan has in his roadmap. If you're looking at just the Social Security end of it, there was a Social Security plan called Ryan-Sununu that was out in 2005 that we were big fans of. So there are ways you can handle the longer-term problems without raising taxes as well. But certainly in the short term, you absolutely do not need to raise taxes.
Jacob Hacker, just restrain spending. That'll do it.
Well, it's just unrealistic. And I mean, one of the things that I would want to emphasize, I agree with Brian, by the way, that there really is a short versus a short to medium term versus long term problem. And one of the things I would emphasize is that talking about what the historical share of the budget of the economy was taken up by taxes is a bit misleading, because over a lot of this period we were spending more. So, for example, in the Reagan years, we peaked at about 22% of GDP in spending, even though we were taking in, you know, less than 20% in taxes. So if we really want to cut the deficit, then we have to face up to the fact that we have to actually have spending and revenues roughly in line. So it shows a lack of seriousness about dealing with that long-term problem. But the long-term problem, I think it's really important to emphasize again that the long-term problem is runaway healthcare costs. And the roadmap for America's future that Paul Ryan has put forth basically says that we're going to deal with that long-term problem by privatizing Medicare and Social Security. Even the more moderate Simpson-Bowles proposal says that we should turn the Medicaid program into a voucher, which means that elderly Americans who are in nursing homes and those who are getting coverage for the first time through the new health care reform are going to be, you know, pitted in this very, very tough state budgetary environment against a whole lot of other claims. So I believe strongly that we can deal with this long-term problem, but I think that we have to be both realistic about what needs to be done, but even more important, we have to be clear about what's happened over the last generation. I mean, this vastly more unequal society where we're not making those investments in the middle class, and middle class Americans are deeply hurting right now. And this is basically saying, you know what, that's just the reality. Now we have to start to tighten our belt. And I think we need to really think much more fundamentally about how we create a prosperous middle class society for the long term.
Ryan, what about that? I mean, we've seen inequality grow and grow. That has benefited some people, a relatively small number, enormously. But I don't know anybody who says that's really a sign of a healthy society. People are starting to call our country, you know, a banana republic in its income distribution.
Well, a couple things there. First, if you take a look at tax progressivity over time, that's something that Maya mentioned earlier, and I agree we should have a progressive tax system in this country. It's only fair that if you earn more, you should pay more. The tax system since the Tax Reform Act of 86 has gotten more and more and more progressive over the last 30 years. In fact, the last 10 years, you'd figure that with tax rates going down on the top end, it would become more regressive.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, it has gotten more progressive over the last 10 years.
Because of what, income supports at the lower end or what?
Well, it's mostly because people that are high income, if they get a percentage raise, let's say that you're making $1 million and you get a 5% raise, you've just gotten a $50,000 raise. That's likely to bring more and more people into higher and higher tax rates. You have what might call real bracket creep, but really it's just a matter of...
If you make $1 million, you're already pinning the needle on the tax.
Well, that's true, obviously. But if someone's making a couple $100,000 and they get a $20,000 or $30,000 raise, then they're more likely to be in a higher tax bracket than someone who's making $30,000 getting the same percentage raise, getting a $2,000 or $3,000 raise. That's the same percentage, but the income inequality just increased because you're starting from higher absolute numbers.
Let's go to Timothy in Des Moines, Iowa. Timothy, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. If the general idea has been to shift the wealth up in our society, and we're looking to solve that's caused the problem, and if we're looking to solve the problem, why can't we find a solution that will provide a correlation between those who benefited from the wealth being shifted up and those who haven't? Why can't we solve the problem, like, on that basis?
Ask those who benefited so much in the last few decades to pony up to fix the deficit?
Yeah, the word we're not saying here is greed, and greed is wrong.
Yeah,
those who have millions and millions really could let go of some. It wouldn't hurt them.
Well, okay. Jacob, what do you say?
I actually agree. And I think, you know, go back to my analogy, which maybe wasn't clear enough, about the fact that we've had this big party that the bar was roped off and the very well off were at the bar enjoying free drinks. What I would argue is that we have to think about, okay, now that we are facing up to this long-term problem, how do we distribute the bar tab more fairly? Right. The Deficit Commission's proposal basically says, you know what, everyone's got to share more or less equally in the pain. We'll exempt some at the bottom, but the middle class really has to bear a big part of the burden. And I just would say that absolutely we should be asking those at the top to pay more of the tab that they enjoy, where they enjoyed the drinks. And you know, Ryan mentioned that the tax code has grown – said that the tax code has grown more progressive, and that's simply not true. At the very high end, effective tax rates have come way down. That is the amount that people actually pay. The top 400 taxpayers paid an average federal individual income tax rate of around 40% in the 1960s. It was around 30% in the 1990s, and it was around 16.5% in 2007. And that's ignoring a whole host of ways in which those at the very top have gotten treated well by the tax code. For example, hedge fund managers get to pay 15% capital gains tax rate on some of their incomes because of this carried interest loophole in the tax code. I would say that the most exciting aspect of the commission's proposal is that it would actually argue that we should treat capital gains as just other forms of income. And that, to me, that shows real bravery. But I think overall, the general thrust of it is to say, look, you know, the party's over. We need to tighten our belts when there are some people whose belts have been very loose. And I'm afraid that the belt that's being tightened is around the neck of the middle class.
We're talking about deficit reduction. Bob in Columbia, South Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Great show. Listen, I want to address the Social Security. It just seems to be an unequal deal here. I used to make a nice six-figure income, and I was very comfortable, and I'd work till May to pay my Social Security. There
right.
was a cap on it. I believe there still is.
Yeah.
And I'm going, why don't we, rather than try and raise the age, because you're still 65, 65, 66, whatever age you're going to retire at, you're physically. So you might be living longer, but I don't know how well you are going to be able to attack your job, and you will run into limitations. Why not take the simple progress that just or the and continue the 4% tax, the Social Security tax, all the way through the income level there, and not stop it at 75 or 115,000. I think it is right now. Just hey, if a guy makes $1 million a year, by golly, he gets 4% towards Social Security.
Yep, Bob, let us look at exactly that. Let us pick it up. Maya, how about it? Instead of, you know, having people out there working until they're 68, 69, maybe older one day, you know, have people pay Social Security taxes right up on the entirety of their income. That's never been the way. Should we be thinking about it now?
Well, it is the way for Medicare. It's not the way for Social Security. Mm-hmm. And it's because Social Security is meant to be a plan where you pay in revenues and then you get out in benefits. And if you lift the cap up all the way, suddenly, you know, the Bill Gateses of the world are going to be getting much larger Social Security benefits. You haven't actually fixed the problem so much as pushed it out into where all those benefits have been promised down the road. If you were to do that, if you were to lift the cap more, and let me say,
Wait, may I just ask you, is that really how it would work? I mean, if you paid more, you're going to end up getting millions in Social Security if you're Bill Gates? Really? I thought there was a cap
benefits,
on what you could get to, your benefits.
Your benefits would be adjusted. Your placement rate, to get into the technical mm-hmm. terms, mm-hmm. is lower at the higher end, but you'd still get some benefits for that contribution.
Some.
Yes, and I was about to say, if you do that plan, you actually should sever the higher benefits. You should just have the revenues that go into Social Security at the very high end be helping the overall system, but not linked to more benefits, because we don't need to keep ramping up the system. This plan actually does lift the payroll tax cap, not all the way, but back to about 90% of payroll. And that's one option. In defense of the retirement age, because I really think we have to look at what the problems in Social Security come from, we are all living longer. Not everybody can work longer, but most of the population can. And what we're saying is that by the year 2075,
mm-hmm.
the retirement age would be 2 years higher than it's currently slated to be. That, to me, does not seem to be an onerous increase in working years, you know, for my son, who's six. And you...
So you say now when he's six, but what's he going to think when he's that age? I mean, is he going to think, oh, gee, you know, I'm in trouble here?
Well, the bottom line is that when he's close to retirement, we're going to have changed this Social Security system many, many times to adjust it for whatever's going on in the economy in the country at the time. I think it's not so much that we're trying to lock in a system today for the next 75 years, but we're trying to not overpromise, which is what we've been doing in the past. We've put out promises in Social Security and Medicare that we have no ability to make good on. And that adds all the instability in the world. If you don't know what level of your Social Security benefit that's been promised will actually be there, how do you plan for retirement? So I think we need to make promises that are fiscally sustainable and then understand that they'll be adjusted upwards or downwards in the next decades, as it should be. You want some flexibility in the budget because changes will happen down the road. That's one of the things that we've seen. I think the Social Security plan that they put forward makes so much sense because it reflects that we're living longer. It reflects a technical improvement to the way that we adjust cost of living adjustments. It asks those at the high end to pay more, and it's very balanced. It's not about fixing the budget. It's about keeping Social Security strong and solvent into the future. And I think they came up with a remarkably balanced plan that would do that.
Let me just canvass all three of you real quick here. We heard Lori Montgomery at the top say, you know what, this isn't going to happen for all the talk about it. Ryan, do you think this is going to happen? Are we going to get a big deficit reduction plan out of all this work?
No, we're not.
What does that mean?
Well, the problem is this is one of these proposals that's going to come out, and the fact that the commission chairs themselves put it out rather than waiting to see if they can get 14 out of the 18 commission members to vote on it is a pretty good indication in my mind that the commission chairs aren't confident that they're going to get a full majority, supermajority commission report.
So they won't even get it out of the commission. Jacob, let me canvass you. Are we going to get something? Are we going to get action out of this? And if not, are we all just running around like chickens with our heads cut off?
Well, in the short term, I don't think we will. I think this is much more revealing as an indicator of where Planet Washington is, and it's very far from Planet Earth, where people are really worried about the economy. But I do fear that we're not going to be facing up to these shorter-term challenges of the economy while we're debating tax cuts and deficit reduction.
Maya, last word to you. You're the most supportive here. Do you think something might actually happen? Could it? Should it?
I think it's a game changer, and it's no longer going to be so easy to just say no. People are going to have to start saying what they would do to fix the problem. I think it's the beginning of the conversation. Let's hope we get something done before credit markets force us to, because sooner or later we're going to have
to.
Do these.
Maya McGinnis, Ryan Ellis, Jacob Hacker, thank you to each of you for being with us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.